Okay, good morning and good evening to the evening study. If we haven't met before, my name's Megan Granigan. My family has been at Trinity for a little over 7 years. It's wild and crazy at our house. We've got three boys, and so yeah, there's that. We are studying Matthew 5, 21 through 30 today. And so just to kind of get it at the front of our minds, let me read this the passage first, and then we'll start talking. Okay. Said, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says you fool will be liable to the hell of fire. So if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than your whole body go into hell. Okay, so we're talking about anger and lust, and if you were hoping to duck out, you missed your chance during prayer, so join me in this. Okay, so if you, as you were reading and as you've been reading the Sermon on the Mount, this kind of passage where we're talking about like the different commandments, if that feels really heavy for you or unobtainable for you or just kind of confusing even, you're not alone. Me too. I love this saying that I found. It just was an ancient saying. It was in John Pennington's commentary. I looked, could not find who actually said it. But it summarizes what we're going to talk about, saying that Christ's commandment contains the law, but the law does not contain Christ's commandments. Therefore, whoever fulfills the commandments of Christ implicitly fulfills the commandments of the law. And I just kind of liked how it's kind of that, like a rectangle is a square, or a square is a rectangle kind of deal, whatever it is. So we know that the Old Testament law served a couple of different purposes. It was the Jewish people's way of being able to commune with God. It was how God wanted to have a relationship with his people, right? And so he gave them the law and the commandments. It also served as a measuring stick, even now, I think, for us, to show us exactly how inept, how inadequate we were at coming to God with righteousness ourselves, that we cannot keep up, we cannot fulfill the law, right? And so we look at the Israelites over hundreds and hundreds of years, and we show them trying to uphold the commandments and the laws. But we also see people forgetting, almost immediately sometimes. We see people just directly disobeying. And then we see people that are skewing and perverting the God-given commandment or law. We see this in the New Testament and in this passage specifically with the Pharisees, where they would take God's commandment and their law, and then they would build out kind of like fences, if you will, laws upon laws, so that we wouldn't get to the commandment itself. One modern day example even to look at is on the Sabbath. Like, an Orthodox Jew is commanded not to even turn on a light switch or operate their oven, because the Sabbath is for you to rest and to keep it holy, and so we don't want to do the work of turning on the light switch. But nowhere in scriptures does it say, don't turn on a light switch, don't use electricity. And so it's kind of like an example of like what was happening back then. So then Jesus comes in and says, here are the commandments. And then kind of like expounds, it seems like, right? It's often treated like he's somehow deepening or expanding the commandment here. And that would kind of show some discontinuity, right? Like, well, okay, we had the law, now we're needing more laws. But that's not what he's doing. He's not upping the ante of God's righteous standards. He's not saying, you think murder is bad? Just wait. God is going to get even more hardcore. Brace yourselves. God never ignored or disregarded the ethical state and the inner disposition of a person, their heart, right? Pennington says it best, and so I'm just going to borrow from him. Any repentance that happens must be more than merely external behavior. So more just than the actions, more than don't murder or don't commit adultery. Or else it's not true repentance. And many times the prophets do not reprove the people for external acts, but for going through the motions with a heart that is not aligned with God. The prophets aren't, condemning the people because they aren't doing the acts, right? It's because they're doing it with an empty heart. Jesus is pulling back the veil on outward ethics that the Pharisees have been teaching. And reminding God's people, especially the extra super duper holy ones, the Pharisees, that true righteousness cannot be construed as mere outward obedience. That's what we're seeing in these passages. Jesus takes up a command from the Jewish tradition, and without overturning it, he shows the true intent and the practical reality of the commandment. All the while, and I love this part, driving home his point with the urgency and light of his own coming. So he's taking the commandment and he is pressing onwards because he knows what lies ahead. He knows that soon there will be the cross and the kingdom is coming, and he wants these people to, follow after Christ and to have real heart change. So as he expands and kind of like deepens our understanding in contrast to the Pharisees. So the Pharisees are like building out the fences. He is deepening our understanding of the actual truth and law. He's aimed at the root of all things, our hearts. He doesn't give us frivolous rules, but in taking good God-given commandments shows us what they look like at the deepest level in our hearts and in view of the kingdom that's coming. John R. Stote put it well. He is deepening, and I add, our view of, not destroying the commandments. So he's deepening our view of the commandments. He's not destroying them. So if the next few passages feel like a moral rule book or anything, they're actually an example and a playbook of what life is truly like in the kingdom as sons and daughters of God. And so we should be encouraged by that. We see each exegesis, which is basically just like an example, kind of a teaching tool. It has three parts. It has the Torah statement, it has Jesus's explanation of the true intent, and then it has practical application. So why anger and lust? What do these two groupings of sin have in common? Why would God put them together? Because it does kind of feel like a little, for me, it, like discombobulated a bit. At the root of both of these problems, we're stripping away the identity and the value of a person. If you get to the root of anger, if you get to the root of lust, you're going to see that it is basically stripping out, the soul of a person from the body. So we'll start with murder. We know in Exodus 20:13 says, thou shalt not murder or you'll be liable to judgment. Anger, and then Christ expounds on it and kind of deepens it with anger. Some texts and manuscripts add the words without cause to verse 22. So it would read, but I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother without cause will be liable to judgment. Now, it's probably not the best translation, but it does kind of open us up for a discussion for righteousness, righteous anger versus sinful anger. We know that not all anger is wrong, right? The Old Testament especially, we see the wrath of God, like the anger of God, coming down on the enemies of his people. We can see that in the very beginning in Genesis 3, where God's wrath comes down on the serpent in the garden, and he puts forth curses on the serpent for what's been done. Then we fast forward a little bit, we see God's wrath and God's anger, his righteous anger, coming down on Egypt and on Pharaoh for how he's been treating his people. And then on Jericho. And then if you fast forward to the Gospels, we see Christ exhibiting righteous anger. We see him overturning tables in the temple when they had forgotten that the temple was to worship God. We see him having righteous anger on sin's effect on the world, like when he loses his friend Lazarus and sin's the death of sin in the world. And then finally, we see Christ absorbing the wrath of God on the cross on our behalf. And so I love what Martin Luther says about righteous anger. He says, anger of love is one that wishes no one evil, one that is friendly to the person but hostile to the sin. So as we're thinking through what righteous anger looks like for us, we need to look back at the characteristics of Jesus and his anger. We see that Jesus is slow to anger. God is described as slow to anger. We know that about his character. A lot of times with Jesus, we see anger mingled with grief, like the sadness of the brokenness in our world, sin's effect on our world, and how that affects Christ. We even see, we do see with Christ, not having anger over personal mistreatment. And I think that that should have a qualifier, because you can be angry, righteously angry, at the treatment of yourself or someone else in sin, but Christ was led to the cross and, you know, like a lamb to the slaughter. So we know that part. Unrighteous anger, what does that look like? Have y'all ever heard anger is a secondary emotion? Yes. That used to bother me a lot, because I was like, no, I'm just angry. Well, why am I just angry? It often takes the, you know, takes a look of pride, of vanity, of hatred, or malice, or even revenge, right? Like, when we're angry about something, maybe we're angry about something that something was, you know, done to one of our kids or to a family member, and then it turns into revenge. We can often see it as, like, quick and reactionary, like, it is out. I know I've done this a bunch. It's out before you even know that it's in your mouth, like, woo, you know, kind of deal. But I think especially for women, or at least for me, it can fester. And so I think of it kind of like this. Have y'all ever seen or read The Lord of the Rings? We're going to go nerdy for a second. Yes, Lord of the Rings. Okay, so you know Gollum and his precious, yes? So Gollum was originally Smeagol, and Smeagol was like a hobbit-like character. He looked normal, like he, you know, I mean, he participated in all those things. And one day he happens across the ring, and it's the ring that controls all the other rings in, you know, the land of Lord of the Rings, if you will. And it quickly consumes him. The ring, so much so that he's no longer Smeagol. You can't recognize him. He loses his identity. He loses his name even. And the next thing we see is Gollum. And that's, you know, kind of who we know in the stories. And Gollum is wasted away. He's unkempt and he's uncared for. You can see his ribs. He's sallow. He's got greasy, like real stringy hair and stuff in the movies, because he has one purpose. And it's his ring, his precious. And he's got to, that was a good impression. It was not intentional. Anyway, I should be worried about that. But his precious. And so, and that's what sinful anger does. Kind of comes into our life unassuming. Maybe it comes in as righteous anger. Maybe we're angry about that mistreatment of our kid or of our friend and everything. But then it settles in and we allow it to. And it begins to consume us, and we nurture it. And we pet it and stroke it, because that's what our sinful desire wants us to do. And all of a sudden, we wake up one day and we're Gollum. We have this like growing force in us, and we don't know how it took root and how it's gotten so deep. And so, as Christ continues on about anger, he talks about angry speech. We have a couple of different words that he, you know, speaks about. The first one would be raka. And so we know raka is to insult more a person's intelligence. It would be like us saying, like, oh my gosh, you're such an idiot, like, you're so stupid, you know, that kind of thing. It insults its brain more than its heart. And then the second, our ESV translation, I think, says fool, but it's more. It's the root word in which we get our words moron or sophomore, wise fool, right? It's more aimed at the, like, contempt for a person's heart or their character. And so it's towards that contempt and, like, that desecration of someone's heart that Jesus kind of seems to get really riled up here, right? He says Jesus says that showing that contempt towards that, you know, calling them the fool, will put someone to be the subject of the hell of fire. And the hell of fire is actually referencing Gehenna. Gehenna was a smoldering dump outside the walls of Jerusalem. It was where all of the city's refuge went. In some of the articles I read, it even talked about, like, child sacrifice, like bodies being dumped into Gehenna, but, like, the smoldering never went out, and it stank. It was not where you wanted to be. And in, you know, this day and time, they would also kind of, like, allude to it as, like, a hell. Like, it was a good example of a hell. And so Jesus is saying that so too are we liable if we degrade a person like that, if we strip their value away like that. Jesus is getting to the heart that we should treat no one, young or old, weak in mind or weak in body, as though they have no value. No person on this earth is good for nothing or lacking in value, because God valued us enough that he gave his only son for us, even like while we were still sinners. We had nothing to bring to him for justification or for the fact that we mattered enough for him to give his son, and he did. And so that's why Christ gets so riled up in this passage, because we are so worth value that don't you dare strip that value of, you know, of one of his image bearers. So angry, let's see, Stoat says it well. Anger and insult are ugly symptoms of a desire to get rid of someone who stands in our way. Our thoughts, looks, and words all indicate that, as we sometimes dare to say, we wish he were dead. Such an evil wish is a breach of the sixth commandment, and it renders the guilty person liable to the very penalties to which murderers expose themselves. Not in each case literally in a human law of court, because no court can charge a person for being angry, but before the bar of God. And I just really liked kind of that quote. So sin is universal. We're all probably sweating a little bit because we've all probably at least said fool, if not a whole lot worse. I know I have. Probably this week. Probably not today, but probably this week. And so how do we proceed? Like, what should we do in following Christ? And Christ outlines two examples, for us. And I love that it's two examples. One is your brother and sister, and then one is your enemy. And in both cases, the situation's the same. Someone has a grievance with us. And the solution is the same in both instances, that we are to stop and go immediately and urgently to ask for forgiveness and to rectify the wrong. Now take note on this. Jesus does not say that go if the brother or sister has a right to be offended or if their anger is reasonable. That's not what he's saying. It's not when you think it's justified you should go. It's if they have a grievance, you should go. So it's important reconciliation for believers that Jesus urges a person to stop what he's doing, even in the sacred act of worship. Stop where you are, go take care of it. As you think about this though, here's my caveat. Not all reconciliations are like real neat and clean, are they? I know when I was doing the Bible study, I'm sure y'all thought the same thing. What if I go and I try and make the reconciliation and the person wants none of it, right? Like, that's kind of a fear that we have. We are still supposed to be at peace with people to the best of our ability. It does not mean that you need to continuously beat the door down for reconciliation. Go and make true reconciliation, make amends, and then trust that God will take care of the other side. They may not reconcile. They may not forgive in this lifetime, but you have obeyed and you have been faithful to God's call. Remember from last week's lesson, we were talking about salt and light. So one of the big purposes in the passage and also just like in that time period was for preservation. So when they would cut the meat, they would immediately apply salt to it because salt basically stopped any encroachment of bacteria or of mold into the cut of meat, right? It would protect it and it would preserve it. And I kind of think of that like those difficult reconciliations, any reconciliation, but the ones where you just aren't sure if it's going to be one-sided. Because at the very most, if we apply our salt, if you will, if we apply our reconciliation and go and make amends, the hope is that it dampens their fire, the other party's fire, a little bit. Because it's kind of hard to be angry when someone says, truly, I'm really sorry. I've wronged you and I'm sorry. It's also hard to help for those to want to like slander you or to talk about you or to call you names and everything. And so in doing so, like you're putting out peace around you, but you're also kind of working backwards on the angry speech part. Does that make sense at all? Like using that salt and light, using that reconciliation, it kind of takes the fire out of both parties, yours and theirs. So next, we're gonna move into adultery. We got through anger. Let's do adultery. So we see Christ moving into adultery. Jesus deepens our understanding that unfaithfulness will include lust. I want to stop for a minute and talk about what he is calling, that he's not calling out sex, as it was designed between a husband and a wife to be sordid or dirty. That is not where Christ is going with this. And these commands he's seeking to actually protect and to honor sexual love as its beauty and incredible power and mystery that is God-given. Right? So we're going to talk a little bit about what lust is and what it's not. I want to give credit, though. A lot of kind of what we're going to talk about came from Tim Frickenschmidt down in Austin at All Saints. He preached on it about a year ago, and it was just so good that I was like, okay, that makes more sense and everything. Because I think that we can get it wrong a lot. I think specifically the church can get it wrong a lot of like we, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater. Okay, so he is not saying that sexual love is lust. And in sexual love, we see like a few different kind of viewpoints in our world. We see what we would call the pagan view, that sexual love is just like an appetite, right? It's like eating or drinking. It's just a biological need or a drive. You don't need to personalize it. It doesn't affect your soul. And your soul is really important. It matters, but your body's temporary. So just go ahead and take care of it. It's just, you know, satiate your appetite. That's kind of what the pagans say. And honestly, it's kind of what our world says right now. It's not connected to your soul. You just need to do it. It's primal. Then we see another view. Tim Keller calls it the prudish view. It's what we see in the church a lot. I know I saw it growing up a little bit, and y'all may have seen it and been affected by it, but it's that sex is generally like a dirty, sex in general was dirty and was allowable only for the higher good of having children and building up the family name. But you should repress your desires because they're not good. But then the true and right view of Christianity shows that that couldn't be more the opposite of what God intended. Because we see that when God creates Adam and Eve, Adam like breaks out in song. He breaks out in poetry. Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Like, it's good. It's powerful. And that sexual love is just, it's a sign, a true and participatory sign of a taste of who God is and what he's like and how he loves. Sexual love shows the beauty and the strength and the mystery created by God. I love, it's a unitive act of souls and bodies becoming one. This whole time we've been talking about disunity, and this is a unitive act. Hebrew boys, so much so, like, do we know about this? But, like, the Song of Solomon, did y'all know Hebrew boys could not read it before they were bar mitzvahed? I didn't know that, but, like, if you go back and read Song of Solomon, it makes a lot of sense. lust, however, is different. It's adultery of the heart. It underestimates sexual desire and its power and its goodness and its mystery. I love that. It underestimates it. And I think we do that in our world a lot. Like, we think it's just sex. We think it's just the body. It's, you know, we're not doing anything. We're not actually doing the adultery. But we're underestimating its power. It's not acknowledging the God-given beauty of a person. Jesus isn't talking about, like, just, like, looking at someone and going, like, gosh, they're beautiful, you know. That's not what we're talking about. It's a look, and it's like a verb that's like the looking and looking and looking, like the desire. It's a look full of desire. When I was in college, I went with a group of girls. It was a school trip to Italy and Paris and everything. And so it was all interior design and fashion design girls. So we're dressed in the nines, and we're just beat bopping around. You know, it's like little Baylor girls and stuff. And we would get on the subway, and then the Italian, like, young guys would look. That was like a look of lust. I mean, you just felt like you were practically naked right there. And I couldn't wait to get off the subway because it just felt so awkward. And that's what Jesus is talking about, not, you know, looking at anyone. And so lust aims to possess and use to satisfy our own desires. It's dehumanizing, like tearing apart body and soul to treat them only as a body. And lust, we don't want a person and all that it brings. We don't want their story, their family, their souls. We want the experience. We want the commodity of the body to, like, do our own experience, right? Here's the funny. The views of pagan, like, the pagan and prudish views of sexual love we just talked about, it's the same as lust. It's tearing apart what God has joined together, tearing apart the body and the soul. When God, in his goodness and in his wisdom, put a body and a soul together for this, like, mysterious act. And so you really can see pulling it apart. Okay, so what are we supposed to do when we face that temptation, when we face the temptation of being angry? We're created with this good and wonderful desire, like, and, you know, sexual desire that's in us and that's good. How do we honor it to use it in a way that God intended us to? Christ calls out to cut off the offending member of your body and throw it away. Do we actually have to do that? No. In fact, in my research, y'all get kind of a kick out of this. There were a few Christians over the years who have, like, taken it very literally. including a 3rd century scholar. His name was Origen of Alexandria, who after, like, amongst other things, sleep deprivation and food deprivation, actually castrated himself. This is a really, like, PG-13 lecture, guys. Castrated himself. And you'll be glad to know that the Council of Nicaea actually forbid the practice in 325 after that happened. So we're good. Jesus isn't saying cut things off. He is saying avoid the temptation at all costs. Because by falling into the sin of lust, we subject ourselves to our souls to become like the aforementioned Gehenna, the stinking, smoldering trash heap. It takes one step towards that, and how quickly we go into Gehenna. And Jesus sees our souls and our salvation as so important that he would rather us do away with anything that perverts what was intended as a gracious and beautiful gift to us to protect our souls. So what does it look for us? Look like for us? We're going to fall short, right? Like daily. On the anger, on the lust, all of it. You don't be surprised when you do. How are we supposed to keep going on it? The answer is, as it always is Christ's grace. We're going to rely on cross. We're going to, rely on Christ. We're going to lean in on his grace, both to repent of our sins as they come across, but also to walk with him daily and become more in his likeness. The only way we're able to stand before God is through Christ's own righteousness. It's not the law. We already saw that didn't work. It is purely through Christ's righteousness that we're able to stand. And he knew that his work on the cross would right every wrong and cover every sin. So as we lean on him, know that we now live as heirs of the kingdom and his image bearers as always for the one and true King. And in our actions, we can strive to walk step by step with him. And when we do fall, because we're going to, that he will pick us back up and that the forgiveness is always there.